My guest today, Robert Fisk, is the dean of all Middle East correspondents, having lived and worked there for the past 43 years, arriving in Beirut in the midst of the Lebanese Civil War, where he has since resided. Over those years, while winning multiple awards, he has covered five Israeli invasions, the Iran-Iraq War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, Algerian Civil War, Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, the Bosnian and Kosovo Wars, the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, and the 2011 Arab Revolutions. He joined The Independent in 1989 after resigning from The Times, objecting to Rupert Murdoch's purchase of the paper. He has written two major best-selling books on the Middle East, Pity the Nation, about Lebanon, and The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. The last time Robert was my guest on Takes on the World was 2005, when I interviewed him in his Beirut apartment overlooking the Mediterranean. It's been too long. Welcome back to Takes on the World, Robert Fisk.
Hi.
Glad to have you here. Listen, today's or Tuesday's...
Can I just interrupt you one thing there, Jeffrey?
Yes.
You said I resigned from the Times in opposition to Rupert Murdoch's purchase of the paper. That is not true. Rupert Murdoch had purchased the paper many years before. I resigned from the Times because they declined to publish a front-page story, which they originally wanted to, saying that an Iranian Airbus had been shot down over the Gulf, this is in 1988, by an American warship because the American captain had panicked. They preferred to run an editorial saying that the pilot of the Iranian passenger plane was a suicide pilot, which wasn't true. And inquiry by the U.S. did prove indeed that the American warship crew had been panicking as they fired at the passenger aircraft. As a result of that, the Times did not carry my story, which was true, although Irish papers did, and I resigned from the Times and joined the Independent. It was nothing to do with Murdoch himself, though, of course, his influence was very obviously over the paper.
Well, thank you for clarifying that and recalling that story. The USS Vincennes shot down the Iranian passenger plane. It's a story we don't hear about, and thanks for bringing it up. You know, Tuesday's love-in in Singapore with Kim Jong-un has been grabbing the headlines and monopolizing our airwaves. And I've been feeling this may be a sideshow to make Americans less aware of what's happening in the Middle East, which we've been writing about with regard to Iran and Syria. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because a very dear colleague of mine made the point yesterday while watching this nonsense on television that this might be about Iran. This might be a way of being able to push the American line that Iran is the, you know, the dangerous nuclear power by showing that, in fact, it's possible to defang, as the Americans like to say, North Korea's nuclear powers. It's interesting that the man who is prepared to talk to a tyrant who has nuclear weapons, not just is wants to develop them, but who's got nuclear weapons, and who carries out atrocious human rights abuses, that Trump should be prepared to talk to him, but to actually tear up an agreement which has prevented Iran from manufacturing nuclear weapons, and of course having no interest at all in talking to the Iranians.
Well, you know, we hear and read on a regular basis, like a mantra, that not only is Iran the leading sponsor of state terror, but that it essentially now controls both Syria and Lebanon, where you live. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's rubbish. The problem is now that this story, I suppose the cliche is this narrative, has become so widespread, so accepted by not just all the mountebank experts in New York and the various, you know, presenters on television and the New York Times and so on and so forth, that it's become the truth. Now, you know, I travel all the front lines of Syria, and I last saw a few Iranian Revolutionary Guards, maybe 12, on the front lines southwest of Aleppo well over a year ago. Since then, east of Aleppo, west of Aleppo, Deir ez-Zor, Palmyra, Tadmor, Homs, Hama, Damascus, with the exception of a few Iranian guards near the Sayyida Zainab Mosque in Damascus, I haven't seen any. I doubt if there's as many, even as 3,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guards or soldiers inside Syria. You know, it oddly reminds me of what happened in 1941 when the British and the other allies invaded Lebanon, which, of course, was under the Vichy French Pétainist pro-Hitler regime. And the first British officer to capture some French soldiers said, "Where are the Germans?" And the French officer said, but there aren't any Germans in Lebanon. Well, there are very few Iranians in Syria. But now everyone has got so used to hearing that they are that they talk about the tens of thousands of Iranian troops in Syria. Now, there are lots of Hezbollah in Syria, and I see them in action, and I see them at Kalamoon on the Lebanese border, and I know they come home many, in many cases, dead in coffins. And there's been some considerable unrest among their families as to what they're dying for in Syria when they're theoretically, they claim to be defending southern Lebanon from Israel. But again, the Hezbollah are under a Lebanese leadership, although clearly financed by Iran and armed by Iran, they have considerable leeway. If they didn't want to be in Syria, they wouldn't be there. And I don't think you can see them as an automatic arm of Iran. However, once you have a civil war, as you did have, of course, in Lebanon between 1975 and 1990, every foreign power becomes involved. The Iranians have been involved in Syria. The Hezbollah have been involved. The Americans are involved. The Kurds are involved. The Turks are involved. The Saudis are involved. The Qataris are involved. The French apparently have some troops on the ground that we don't hear much about them. You know, if you're going to start picking on who has the largest forces, I'd say, well, have a look at Turkey. And they're bringing ISIS, Daesh people, back into Syria. And Turkey's meant to be, or supposed to be, a NATO nation, which it is, and an ally of the United States.
That brings up an article, a very interesting article you wrote about how Trump has opened the door for Putin in the Middle East, and how it's amazing how Putin is able to maintain close relationships with practically every country in the Middle East, even those who are at odds with each other, like Israel and Iran. He's close to Assad, but he's actually very close to Benjamin Netanyahu. I think he has 7 state visits. And that's one thing the U.S. media has underplayed, because it'd be very difficult to explain to the American public why they love Netanyahu, and love Netanyahu and Putin seem to get on very well together. Talk about how Putin has kind of, you call him the man for all seasons, how he has managed to, with kind of a charm offensive, to be welcome everywhere.
Well, you can be a man for all seasons if your opposite number in the White House is a crackpot. And the problem, of course, as we all know, though very few journalists seem to say this quite as bluntly, is that the president of the United States is crazy. He's insane. He should be in a mental establishment. And as a result of that, his leadership of the free world, which used to be the phrase we used about America under Kennedy, Eisenhower, even George W. Bush, doesn't exist. And in this kind of vacuum, I hate to use the word vacuum even, but in this kind of emptiness, this void, men like Putin, who have ambitions to recast their countries as large, powerful nations, can fulfill themselves. And of course, in the Middle East itself, where most leaders, however much they may fawn on Trump, realize he's crackers, they know that they've got to deal with Putin. When an event takes place in the Middle East now, Arabs don't say, oh, what will Trump say? They're sick of reading tweets and they're not interested. They say, what is Putin going to say? And Putin's played it quite skillfully. He's not a very nice guy, but he's a shrewd man. He has a brain. And he's decided he's going to be everyone's friend. And so he can go to Iran and greet the supreme leader. He can be greeted by Netanyahu in Jerusalem. He can call Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister of Israel, who's a racist, as a great Russian, because, of course, he originally came from Soviet Union. What was the Soviet Union? He can make Erdogan into his friend after Erdogan shoots down a plane and Putin threatens to bankrupt Turkey. He can go to see Sisi, the dictator of Cairo, and be taken out to the opera to watch Verdi, which Sisi did at the opera house in Cairo. So Putin is in a very interesting situation. Now, people say, oh, well, you know, he was very angry about what happened in Libya, where he let, effectively, NATO wipe out Gaddafi and thus lost his Russian rights to Mediterranean ports of Benghazi and Tripoli. I'm not sure he cares much about that. I think Putin is much more concerned about what he calls Islamist terror. You see, we think of the Middle East as being, well, we think of Syria as being in the Middle East. But if you go to Moscow, which I do occasionally, Damascus is due south. And if you look south from the Kremlin, first you see Chechnya, the great Muslim threat to the Russian Federation. And just beyond, you see the spires of Damascus. And, of course, Syria is the one country where Russia does still have a warm water Mediterranean port. That's Tartus, and now, of course, the Hamamine Air Base as well. And so Assad, not Assad, as you keep calling it, like all of Assad, does find he's got a loyal ally in Moscow. Remember, Putin doesn't have a lot of time for people who run away. The president of the Ukraine simply disappeared when he ran away. Putin didn't try to prop him up. But Assad has not fled, and Putin props him up. Now, maybe he'd prefer someone other than Assad. If I was Putin, I probably would. But that's what he's got. And the fact is that with Russian military assistance and a lot of air bombing, a lot of good training, as the Russians themselves admit, for their military forces, the Syrian government army, or the Syrian Arab army, as its official name is, has turned the tables on the armed opposition to Assad, whether that be Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, whether it be Daesh, which we call ISIS, whether it be the ghostly and rather imaginative Free Syrian Army, which doesn't really exist anymore, or other Islamist groups. They're on the run, and they've largely been beaten. They haven't been totally conquered any more than they have in Iraq by the Kurds and the Americans and the Iraqi army. But they've pretty much been wiped out in the major cities of Syria. And Putin, of course, if you drive around the streets of Aleppo, you see Putin's picture everywhere. If you go to a checkpoint, people say, Rus, Rusi, Rusi, and wave you through. Obviously, I look a bit like a Russian because I'm a European. And you'll find that there's now, even in Syria, there's a military newspaper run by the Russians in Arabic for the Syrian and Russian armies together, teaching Syrian soldiers about Moscow and giving them how to learn Russian and teaching them, you know, various words in Russian and translating them back into Arabic for Russian soldiers. There's quite a close, I mean, you cannot avoid seeing how close the Russians and the Syrian military are when you're in Syria itself. And that, of course, is obviously what Putin intended. When I was in Aleppo last, I found a number of Russian military intelligence officers researching the results of the bomb craters made by their explosives in eastern Aleppo. And they made it clear to me that their reports did not go to the FSB or military intelligence first. They went straight to the Kremlin. In other words, Putin is a micromanager. He wants to know everything that's going on. You can't say that about Trump, can you?
I very much doubt that. Speaking of Syria, you wrote an article that did not get to the Western press about what actually happened in Douma. And it was very strange because we heard about this attack on a gas attack by the Syrian army at a very critical moment. I forget what the circumstances were, but it would have been very stupid. In any case, all the Western press talked about a gas attack in Douma. You went there. And what did you find?
Yeah, I didn't actually, I didn't say there wasn't a gas attack. I went there to try to find out what I could learn on my own. I was free to move around. I didn't have a minder. I was pretty appalled to find that so few of my colleagues were there. You know, all they had to do was come to Damascus. They could have gone there. I was free to roam around. I found the clinic, which was allegedly attacked with gas. The senior doctor at the clinic, who was not there at the time of the supposed attack, he was in his home 300 meters away, said that the videotape, which we saw, was real, but it wasn't gas. There had been a tremendous amount of shelling by the Russians and the Syrians, of course, which has stirred up dust clouds in the windy streets of Douma. Many people found it difficult to breathe. They came to the hospital, then the panic began. Now, that doesn't mean that the Syrians didn't use chemicals, but it doesn't mean that they did. While I was talking to the doctor, the other doctors at the hospital, at the clinic, who had witnessed the attack, were actually in Damascus giving evidence to the nuclear chemical and nuclear research group, who later went to Douma and who are due to report soon. And maybe they'll say gas was used. I have no idea. But I didn't find anyone in Douma who had actually known or heard of a gas attack on the night in question. American television apparently did. Another American television chain apparently did not. So you take it or leave it. All I was doing was saying, before we assume that all these stories are correct, let's just say, is there another side to the story? Not that the original story is wrong, but it may not be exactly as it seems. And a couple of days later, I got to the so-called nuclear research, chemical research laboratory, which was bombed by 12 cruise missiles. in a campus almost in the center of Damascus. And again, I was allowed for 45 minutes, an hour, I gave up in the end, to wander around the wreckage and the ruins, pulling up bits of paper, which were about agronomy plans and water irrigation plans and the use of plastic in bridges in hot countries and so on and so forth. And I met the head of the research center, which is actually not called research at all, but it's undoubtedly a chemical center, but it's there allegedly for purely academic research. Now, the same nuclear chemical research group that went into Douma, our international group that went into Douma to find out if chemicals were used, whose report we await now, had gone to this target of Trump's attack some 4 months before and said that it was completely clean. There was no evidence it was involved in nuclear research for nuclear weapons or chemical weapons. If it was indeed involved in chemical weapons research, and I didn't find any evidence of it, this must have started in the last 3 months, which is an extraordinary feat by the Syrians. I'm not trying to be not trying to say something about a national characteristic, but the idea that the Syrians could entirely change the research process of a campus like that seems to me very far-fetched. However, that's what Trump claimed, that's what the French claimed, that's what the Americans claimed, that's what NATO claimed, that's what Theresa May claimed. And all I can say is I didn't find the evidence to support that. As a journalist, it's my job to do that. But can I say, well, you know, gas wasn't used in Douma? No, I can't say it wasn't. Nor was can I say it wasn't used before. We know, for example, that Turkish policemen had stopped a truck crossing the border into Syria some years ago, which was carrying chemicals which could be used for attack, and it was going apparently to Daesh, to ISIS, and it was obviously being freighted in courtesy of the Turkish Secret Service. And two journalists who exposed this are still in prison in Istanbul today. But that doesn't mean that Assad couldn't have used chemical weapons, and that he did indeed. It doesn't mean that he actually gave all the chemical weapons over to the UN and after the Putin agreement with Obama. This is a ruthless, cruel civil war, and there's no point in thinking that people like Assad tell the truth. All you can do is try and go there. And all I could, what struck me when I got to Douma, first of all, was that there were so few journalists bothering to go there.
Well, one last question. What is your take on the White Helmets? They seem to be very close to Islam al-Nusra and so on, and seem to move around with so-called rebels. What's your take on
that?
Well,
I've learned a lot about them, but the problem is, of course, that journalists cannot operate on the rebel side, i.e. the ISIS, Nusra, Free Syrian Army side of the front line, because journalists will have their throats cut, and some indeed have had them cut. So we don't see the White Helmets. We have no direct contact with them. They send out pictures, videos, messages, apps, and Facebooks and emails and so on. But there's no actual direct contact, and that is the problem. Now, when I went into eastern Aleppo after it was taken back by the Syrian army, there were lots of documents lying around from inside and around the so-called White Helmets, and also called Syrian Civil Defense by the people on the other side, some of which showed that, for example, I got hold of a document which showed how much they were paid per week and per month. And it was interesting to see that two media advisors to the White Helmets were getting more money paid to them than the actual stretcher bearers and medics, paramedics who were rescuing people. There was one document that showed that they had got a number of militias to stamp their paper that they had free passage inside eastern Aleppo. This is rebel-held Aleppo. One of those stamps was clearly from Nusra, which of course is al-Qaeda. Now, if I was offered a Nusra press card, would I take it? Yes, I probably would. But when you consider the White Helmets are funded by the British Foreign Office, the Norwegian government, and so on, should they be carrying around a pass from al-Qaeda? I don't know. You have to ask these questions. I'm not sure at the moment what I think of them. I'm not saying all their films are fake, which is what the Syrian government claims. I'm not saying they don't rescue people. I'm not saying that women and children are not cut down by Syrian and Russian bombs. Of course they are. I've not the slightest doubt about it. This is on a scale that you can't conceal it all and wipe it all clean by claiming fake news like Assad does. But I do say that everything from casualty figures to films that you see and videotapes has to be, I think the phrase is, filtrated through the mind with great skepticism. It was interesting to me that at the beginning of the Syrian war, civil war, if you want to call it that, everyone was putting out these horrific tapes, alas, with the dead faces of the dead blobbed out, which is unnecessary and I think insulting to dead people. But what happened very quickly is that Al Jazeera, which was showing these tapes, quickly set up a small office in its headquarters in Doha in Qatar to go through the tapes, because they found that some of them were clearly not taken in the place that they were claimed to have been taken in, and one or two of them were not even taken in the year which they were put out. In other words, in one or two cases, there were people who appeared to have been in other places in other films. Now, that doesn't mean they're all fake. It doesn't mean they're all lies. But it does mean that we need to use some skepticism over this evidence, which we have no first-hand contact with. And this is what we need to stress over and over again, that most, almost all of what we get from the White Helmets, there is no direct face-to-face contact as real people between us and them. Everything is coming out on social media, and that's the problem.
Now, I know you have to run, but any kind of last words of warning, advice to American listeners who are fed a steady diet of propaganda?
Well, they have to make up their own minds what to do. It's not for a Brit who wanders around the Middle East to tell Americans what to think. You know, I look back on, thinking of American elections, I look back to the time when Winston Churchill and FDR met to draw up the Atlantic Charter, and FDR was trying to get his presidency again, of course, another election. And the Republicans were claiming, in an attempt to, you know, stop FDR's chances of winning the election, that he was worse than Hitler. And if you see that kind of propaganda going on against a sitting U.S. president during the Second World War, what kind of propaganda is floating around today? You know, they didn't have social media in World War II. You have to ask yourself, hold on a second, what does this mean? Are you reading and seeing everything that's available? That doesn't mean sit on social media and read claptrap by, you know, conspiracy theorists and so on. But at least there are people out there who are trying. I'm not the only journalist who's trying to do what I'm trying to do, which is say, hold on a second, there's another side to the story. There always is. And the final point will be on casualty figures. I still see casualty figures of the Syrian war at 250,000, 350,000, 400,000. The latter comes from the so-called, what is it, Observatory on Human Rights, run by a guy in Coventry in England. But I also remember, for example, reading that when the Nazi Luftwaffe bombed Rotterdam in 1940, the casualty figures were 19,000 dead. When they got the Luftwaffe officers on trial at Nuremberg in 1946, a year after the Second World War, the dead were less than 1,000. In other words, they were exaggerated 19 times for the whole of the Second World War. Good reason, of course, you weren't able to go to Rotterdam and count the dead. The Germans occupied Rotterdam. But we've got to be careful of all the figures and all the dates and all the times, and that includes casualty figures.
Robert Fisk, I want to thank you for being our guest on Takes on the World, and keep up your great reporting. I wish we could see more of it in the American press, where you used to be published, but I guess what you have to say is too dangerous. Thanks.
You can still read The Independent.
Yes, online.
The London Independent. Well, there's one way of... And Patrick Coburn, my colleague, is an equally skeptical reporter on the Middle East. Read him, too.
The Independent, Robert Fisk. You could find it just every day. It's online, a reliable source, which you don't find here. Thanks again for being our guest today, Robert, and the best to you.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.